Hi, anyone? Anyone at all? I'm Joshua Hanson Clark with Infinite Scroll Media Services and Productions, and this is And the Beans Talk, our variety show where we will be presenting short pieces in various languages and also serializing our own original fiction. So, last episode was quite janky and unstructured, I'm aware. This time around, we're going to be actually diving into some material with commentary sprinkled in. And in the time since I recorded last, towards like the beginning of the month, I think the episode went live on the 7th. Yeah, basically everything's changed. As you of course know, we are officially very much in the midst of this outbreak that is derailing regular life for a while. I wish there was more that I could do from where I am, you know, for all of my friends who are struggling and, you know, people I don't know. This whole situation just sucks. It feels like an absurd time to, you know, be doing this, to be podcasting, especially with a focus on classical material, which can be hard to see the relevance of for us in the best of times, let alone now. Anyway, to recap from before, my practice has the basic goal of making ancient, classic, and medieval literature accessible to the common person, starting with myself. I still have a long way to go, but I've gotten to the point that I can transliterate, not translate, different thing, I can transliterate several languages and their respective classic literatures. This puts me in an interesting position because before I know necessarily what a text in another language says, I know approximately how it sounds. It makes itself known to me as an abstract sound art object first. I will do my best to demonstrate this effect with one of the most influential poems ever written, the 23rd Psalm. I have prepared the text in 5 versions: Hebrew, Greek, Latin, Spanish, and English. Now, if I had my way, the Hebrew Bible would be the only version that anyone knew or read. That's always been my position, because biblical ideas really only make sense to me in Hebrew, like in the first place. They hit differently in other languages and often feel wrong in other languages. At the same time, the reality is that I don't really have direct access to the Hebrew. I have a lot of experience with it, over 5 years now, but I still have to use translations, lexicon, concordance, and I'm just as reliant on those basic aids as anyone else. Which has been humbling for me to think about as I was, you know, writing this episode. Nevertheless, I've found over the past 5 years that direct contact with the Hebrew scriptures, learning the vocab, the grammar, the literal shape of the canon, that goes a long way toward breaking my own biases down. So I figure that it could do the same for other people. At this point, I could go on about the details of my transliteration system, but the main things are that, one, my pronunciation should not be taken as definitive. I have simplified the Nikudot system that determines how the text is traditionally pronounced, so it won't sound the same as you'd hear in a synagogue. The sonic details are slightly different, and I'll probably get into the more technical side of that at some point on my other show, Spitting Dust. Also, instead of attempting to reconstruct the lost pronunciation of the holy name of God, or replacing it with Adonai, as is standard, I replace it with Eloah, which is the singular form of Elohim. Elohim is used to refer to God almost as often as the holy name, but even though it's plural, it's a plural form, its pronouns are always singular, creating a famous grammatical paradox that runs throughout Hebrew scripture and literature. Using Eloah for the holy name helps to emphasize the absolute oneness of the entity, which is a central idea in Judaism to this day, expressed most famously in the Shema Yisrael prayer. Eloah Eloheinu, Eloah Echad. In this context, Eloah then serves as a basically the equivalent term to Allah in Aramaic and Allah in Arabic. So, with that groundwork laid, here is Psalm 23 in Hebrew. Mizmor le David. Eloah ro'i, lo echsar. Bin ot deshe yarbitzeni, al me menuchot yenahaleni. Napshi yeshobeb. Yancheni b'magale tzedek, lema'an shemo. Gam ki elek b'ge tzalmoet. Lo ira ra ki ata imadi, shibtaka umish antaka, hema yenachamuni. Ta'arok lepanai shulchan neged zorarai, dishanta b'shemen roshi, kosi rewaya. Ak tob wachesed, yirdapuni kal yeme chayai, Veshabti bebeit Eloah le'orek yamim. So even without understanding it, you can hear that the progression of the piece is basically the same as the version we all know, the Lord is my shepherd, etc. The website Bible Hub is excellent because you can click on each of the words and it will lead you to a database portal that shows where else that word appears. So for the verb echsar, translated as I want, you can go to its profile page, basically, and see that it first appears in Genesis 8, describing the process of floodwaters decreasing off of the surface of the earth. Same goes for rabatz, to lie down. That verb first appears in Genesis 4, very early, where sin is described as lying in a metaphorical doorway, waiting to make Cain its victim. So you can see how every word in the Bible refers back to an earlier context, usually from the Torah. The phrase me menuchot, typically translated as still waters, is more literally waters of rest, with the plural form menuchot indicating an abundance of rest. Menucha, the word for rest or repose, that's what the Sabbath is for. That connection to the Sabbath in this verse is lost in translation. He leads me beside the still waters. That has nothing to do with the Sabbath. Instead, we have the image of, you know, a sheep and a shepherd ambling along next to a placid pond, which is nice and pastoral and poetic, but not as meaningful as what you find in Hebrew. It's just not. For any Christian churchgoers listening, it's worthwhile to grill your priest or pastor on this stuff because they should know it already. If I had my way, any church authority figure, priest, bishop, whoever, who lacks a working knowledge of Hebrew and Greek, they would be immediately defrocked for failing to meet a baseline level of competence. So I take this very, very seriously. I repeat, if your priest or pastor cannot do a basic multilingual analysis of the most influential Bible passages, I'm sorry, they are not worthy of their office. I'm sure they're very nice. I get that grammar is hard, and I'll cut them some slack on that front, you know, the same way I cut slack for myself. But the vocabulary really isn't. Everyone should know the basic words and concepts. There's no excuse. What could possibly be the excuse for not knowing if, you know, we claim to care about this book so much? Okay, so next we have the Septuagint version, the Koine Greek version made for the Hellenistic Jewish population of Egypt, 200 and change years before Christ. So this was the first full-scale translation effort of the Hebrew Bible into any other language, and most of the quotations in the New Testament use Septuagint wording, which occasionally causes interpretive issues. So here's how it sounds. Psalmas to David, Kyrios poimane me, kai uden me hysterese. Estopon chloes eke me kataskenosen, epihudatos anapauseos exethrepsen me. Tem psychen mu epistrepsen, hodegesen me epitribus dikaiosunis, heneken tu onomatos autu. Εάν γαρ καί παρεύθω εν μέσω σκιάς θάνατου, ουφοβεθέσομαι κακαχώτη σιούμετ εμού ει, χε ράπτος σου καί χε βακτέρια σου, αλταί με παρε καλάσεν. Ετοίμασας ενώπιαν μου τράπεζαν, εξ ενάντιας των θλιβόντων με, ελιπάνας εν ελαίο τεν κεφάλαιν μου, καί το ποτέριον σου μεθιούσκον χως κρατίστον, καί το έλεος σου καταδιώξεται με πάσας τας ημέρας της ζωής μου, καί τα κατοίκεν με εν οίκο Κυρίου εις μακρότητα ημερών. The Septuagint is fascinating because as far as, one of the reasons, as far as I can tell, it's the earliest place where we can see the tradition start to take shape of replacing the holy name with Lord. You've probably heard the phrase Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy, which comes from the Septuagint, eleison me Kyrie, Lord have mercy on me, which translates the very common Hebrew phrase Eloah haneni. I hope you're starting to see the benefits of a multilingual approach. So next, we have the Latin version from the Vulgata of Hieronymus. If you grew up Catholic, you're probably thinking, the what of the what now? The Latin Bible is usually called the Vulgate of Jerome. Why am I pronouncing it like a freak? Well, that's because Church Latin seems to take its pronunciation cues more from Italian, which makes sense. Particularly with the letters V and J. So classically, in Cicero, Caesar's war memoirs, you know, Virgil in Ovid's poetry, etc., V is pronounced W, and J was always I. So we're taking that and running with it, applying classical Latin pronunciation rules to later Christian writing. With that in mind, here is Psalm 23 in Latin. Psalmus David. Dominus regit me, et nihil mihi deerit. In loco pasquae ibi me collocavit. Super aquam refectionis educavit me, anima meam convertit, deduxit me super senitas justitiae. Propter nomen suum. Nam etsi ambulauro in medio umbrae mortis, non timebo mala, quoniam tu mecum es. Virgatua et baculus tuus ipsa me consolata sunt. Parasti in conspectu meo mensam, adversus eos qui tribulant me. Impinguasti in oleo caput meum, et calix meos inebrians quam praeclarus est. Et misericordia tuas subsequetur me omnibus diebus vitae meae, et ut inhabitem in domo domini in longitudinem dierum. Greek and Latin are a trip, because so often you'll hear the ancestors of words that we use every day. Sometimes they're in wildly different contexts, such as the word for staff in Greek is bacteria, and in Latin it's baculus, both of which are found today really only in scientific contexts. The first observed bacteria were shaped like staffs, so they used the Greek word for staff. Simple. And then the same goes for baculum, which is the penis bone found in some, but not all, mammals. Yeah, it's amazing what you find when you really study the Bible. So at this point, I wanted to include the 1537 Thomas Matthews version, which was adapted from William Tyndale's translation work after his death. He was the first to attempt to translate directly from the original Hebrew into English and was killed for his trouble. But the website that I use to read directly from the original pages, BiblesOnline.net, it seems to be missing some psalms from its copy of Thomas Matthew. I'm not sure if that means that they didn't finish the translation in the first place and they published like a selection from the psalms, or if the copy that they scanned for that site is missing pages. If anyone knows what's going on there, or a better source for scans of the Matthew Bible, let me know. So next is a version that I'm very excited about, the 1569 Spanish rendering by Casiodoro de Reina. Apparently, during this period, the Spanish language developed fast enough that de Reina's version was obsolete in just a few decades. It was revised in 1602 by Cipriano de Valera, giving us what is known today as the Reina Valera Bible, or the Biblia del Oso. And the 1569 edition then fell into obscurity. So, here then is Casiodoro de Reina's Spanish rendering of the 23rd Psalm. Please forgive my pronunciation. I'm not nearly as experienced with Spanish. Psalmo de David. Jehová es mi pastor, no me faltará. En lugares de hierba me hará yacer. Junto a aguas de reposo me pastoreará. Hará volver mi alma, guiarme a por sendas de justicia por su nombre. Aunque ande en valle de sombra de muerte, no temeré algún mal, porque tú estarás conmigo. Tu vara y tu callado, ellos me conhortarán. Adornarás mesa delante de mí en presencia de mis angustiadores. Ungiste mi cabeza con óleo, mi copa está revertiendo. Ciertamente, el bien y la misericordia me seguirán todos los días de mi vida, y en la casa de Jehová reposaré por largos días. So, de Reina doesn't bother with the convention of replacing the holy name with Lord. Instead, he transliterates it as Yehovah, or maybe Yehovah. I really don't know enough about the history of Spanish morphology to say exactly. And U's and V's are in a weird state of flux at this point in the history of printing. So, yeah, that isn't the worst rendering of the name that I've ever heard. But I've really gotten to the point where, while I don't personally see a theological reason to obscure the pronunciation of the holy name in the first place, it's just a matter of respect for people who do. Adonai and Eloah work just fine. So I don't want to, you know, offend people unnecessarily by pronouncing it in my Hebrew readings. So finally, we have the version we've all heard, the 1611 Authorized King James rendering. A psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures, he leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul, he leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So for the most part, the 1611 English translation is very conservative, so it's actually weird to me that the final phrase is translated as forever. Usually forever refers or translates the phrase le'olam, to or for eternity. But the Hebrew says, Washabti babet Eloah le'orek yamim, I will dwell in the house of Eloah for a length of days. Changing for a length of days to forever has the effect of kind of universalizing the poem. As written, it looks like it's meant, as written originally, it looks like it's meant to be basically about David relying on Eloah to sustain his kingdom and protect him from his enemies. That's one of David's big poetic themes. But when it's changed to forever, the reader can then interpret it as being about Eloah's relationship with them and with all people. What's subtext in the Hebrew becomes text in this later version. Which raises the question of how the other three versions that we looked at handle the text, which is, when you look, you get an interesting answer. The Septuagint renders it as Es makroteta hemeron, which basically means the same for meant for many days or large amount of days. Jerome handles it basically the same, in longitudinem dierum. Neither of those are the phrases that you usually encounter for to denote eternity, forever. That would be es aionios. I forget what it is for Latin, something I should know offhand. But in Spanish, it's para siempre. And once again, that is not what how Dorena translates it. He has it as por luengos días. So they rendered it more faithfully in this case than the 1611 King James Translator Committee. So that's Psalm 23. It's one of my favorite poems, and it was a really cool process to prepare and present it to you in these various forms. We'll probably be revisiting it later down the line. The Psalms are a gold mine for reciters and interpreters, and they have the benefit of already being extremely popular on the mainstream level. So at this point, I'm going to take a break and insert one of those little music interludes, and I'll see you back in a bit. I love that stupid interlude. It's like, it's one of the only ones from the Anchor FM sound library that like has hit with me. I don't know. It's fun. Shout out to Anchor FM once again, by the way. They are the ones that make this all possible. My cats are being so cute right now. They're all on my bed together. Okay, so at this point, I want to shift gears a bit. As a contrast to Psalm 23, which is kind of like, not necessarily the definitive psalm, but like one of the big ones. And it is a text about, you know, security and contentment. But right now, I want to look at a story that exemplifies the opposite. I'm going to read what may be the single definitive Grimm Brothers tale, The Juniper Tree, since we're already running a bit long. I'm not going to read the German version, especially since it's in Low German, which I don't know the first thing about. I'm not familiar with the like phonology conventions for reading it, like the only German text I've worked with so far is like a few chapters of the Luther Bible and then the Communist Manifesto. The German title for this story is great, though. Von dem Mandelbaum. It was recorded and submitted for inclusion in the first edition of Kinder und Hausmarken by the painter Philip Otto Runge. I'm not sure if it was his original composition or if he got it from somewhere else. It's often difficult to trace, you know, like the oral origins of the material in folktale collections. So for my money, the best way to read the Grimms in English is with a two-volume 1978 collection by Lore Segal and Maurice Sendak, also called The Juniper Tree. They did a fantastic job of selecting and arranging the material, and the result is a book that actually feels and reads like a book rather than a massive data dump. What a concept. It's really, really good, and I highly recommend you get it for yourself. It's not perfect. Like, I had to add a few commas to, like, the doozy of a first sentence in the story we're about to read. But Maurice's illustrations are incredible, as always. Probably my favorite work of his. He also did the book design, so, you know, they're very handsome little hardcover volumes. Look great in any collection. Highly, highly recommend it. So this is The Juniper Tree, as translated by Lore Segal in 1978, from Von dem Mandelbaum, the 47th tale in the first edition of Kinder und Hausmarken, 1812. It's going to sound awkward, and from what I can tell by going phrase by phrase through the Low German text on the website khm.li, if you're curious, it's because she did a really good job translating it, you know, phrase by phrase. This is what Calvino calls it, like, the artlessness of fairy tale and folk legend narration. Before we start, I actually want to dedicate this reading to any young children who are having to stay in difficult or abusive home situations due to the school closures. I hope you all stay fed and safe and are able to find peace in this harsh and confusing time. It is a long time ago now, as much as 2,000 years maybe, that there was a rich man, and he had a wife, and she was beautiful and good, and they loved each other very much, but they had no children, even though they wanted some so much. The wife prayed and prayed for one both day and night, and still they did not, and they did not get one. In front of their house was a yard, and in the yard stood a juniper tree. Once in winter time, the woman stood under the tree and peeled herself an apple, and as she was peeling the apple, she cut her finger, and the blood fell onto the snow. "Ah," said the woman, and sighed a deep sigh, and she looked at the blood before her, and her heart ached. "If only I had a child as red as blood and as white as snow." And as she said it, it made her feel very happy, as if it were really going to happen. And so she went into the house, and a month went by, the snow was gone, and 2 months, and everything was green, and 3 months, and the flowers came up out of the ground, 4 months, and all the trees in the woods sprouted, and the green branches grew dense and tangled with one another, and the little birds sang so that the woods echoed, and the blossoms fell from the trees. And so 5 months were gone, and she stood under the juniper tree, and it smelled so sweet her heart leaped, and she fell on her knees and was beside herself with happiness. And when 6 months had gone by, the fruit grew round and heavy, and she was very still. And 7 months, and she snatched the juniper berries and ate them so greedily she became sad and ill. And so the 8th month went by, and she called her husband and cried and said, "When I die, bury me under the juniper." And she was comforted and felt happy. But when the 9 months were gone, she had a child as white as snow and as red as blood. And when she saw it, she was so happy that she died. And so her husband buried her under the juniper tree and began to cry and cried very bitterly. And then for a time he cried more gently. And when he had cried some more, he stopped crying, and more time passed, and he took himself another wife. By the 2nd wife he had a daughter, but the child of his 1st wife was a little son, as red as blood and as white as snow. Now when the woman looked at her daughter, she loved her so, but looking at the little boy cut her to the heart. It seemed that wherever he was standing, he was always in her way. And then she kept wondering how to get the whole fortune just for her daughter, and the evil one got into her, so that she began to hate the little boy, and would push him around from one corner to the other, and punch him here and pinch him there, so that the poor child was always in a fright. When he came home from school, there was no quiet place he could be. Once the woman had gone upstairs, and her little daughter came up too and said, "Mother, can I have an apple?"
"Yes, my child," said the woman, and gave her a beautiful apple out of the chest.
Now this chest had a great heavy lid with a sharp iron lock.
"Mother," said the little daughter, "couldn't brother have one too?"
This upset the woman, but she said,
"He can have one when he gets back from school."
And as she looked out of the window, she saw him coming, and it was just as if the devil got into her. And she reached out and snatched the apple out of her daughter's hand and said,
"You can't have one till your brother comes,"
and threw the apple back into the chest and closed the lid. And then the little boy came into the door, and the evil one made her speak kindly to him, and she said,
"My son, would you like an apple?"
and looked at him full of hatred.
"Mother," said the little boy, How strange and wild you look! Please give me an apple! And it was as if she must still draw him on, and she said,
Come with me!
And lifted up the lid.
You can pick out your own apple!
And as she... And as the little boy leaned in, the evil one spoke in her ear.
Crunch!
She slammed the lid shut so that the head flew off and rolled among the red apples. And now terror overwhelmed her, and she thought,
How can I get myself out of this?
And so she went up to her room, to her wardrobe, and out of the top drawer she took a white cloth and set the head back on the neck and tied the scarf around it in such a way that you couldn't see anything, and set him on a chair in front of the door and put the apple in his hand. And little Anne-Marie came into the kitchen, where her mother was standing by the fire with a pot of hot water in front of her that she kept stirring around and around. Mother, said Anne-Marie, brother is sitting in front of the door. He looks so white and has an apple in his hand. I asked him to give me the apple, but he wouldn't answer me, and it made my flesh creep.
Go back out, said her mother, and if he won't answer you, you box his ears for him.
And so Anne-Marie went out and said, Brother, give me your apple. But he said nothing, and so she boxed his ears, and his head fell off. And she was horror-stricken, and began to cry and to scream, and ran to her mother and said, Oh, mother, I've hit my brother and knocked his head off! And cried and cried, and could not stop.
Anne-Marie, said the mother, what have you done? But you just keep quiet, and nobody will know. After all, it can't be helped. No, we will stew him in a sour broth.
And so the mother took the little boy and hacked him in pieces and put the pieces in the pot and stewed him in the sour broth. But Anne-Marie stood by and cried and cried, and the tears fell in the pot so that it didn't need any salt. When the father came home, he sat down to supper and said,
And where is my son?
And so the mother brought a big dish of black stew, and Anne-Marie cried and couldn't stop crying. And again the father said,
Where is my son?
Oh,
said the mother,
he's gone on a trip. He went to his mother's great uncle and wants to stay there for a while.
What's he going to do there? And never even said goodbye to me.
Oh, he wanted so much to go. He asked me if he could stay 6 weeks. They'll take good care of him there.
Ah, said the man. Why am I feeling so sad? It doesn't seem right, somehow. He might at least have come and said goodbye to me.
With that, he began to eat and said,
Anne-Marie, what are you crying for? Oh, you'll see. Your brother will be back.
Then he said,
Ah, wife, what good food this is. Give me some more.
And the more he ate, the more he wanted, and said,
Oh, give me more. You can't have any of it. It's as if all of this were for me.
And he ate and ate and threw the bones under the table and finished it all up.
But Anne-Marie went to her chest of drawers and took her best silk scarf out of the bottom drawer and fetched every last little bone from under the table and tied them up in the silk cloth and carried them outside, weeping tears of blood. Then she laid them under the juniper tree in the green grass, and as soon as she had laid them there she felt so much better and didn't cry any more. But the juniper began to stir, and the branches kept opening out and coming back together again, just like someone who is really happy and goes like this with their hands. And then there was a sort of mist coming out of the tree, and right in this mist it burned like fire, and out of the fire flew this lovely bird that sang oh so gloriously sweet and flew high into the air, and when it was gone, the juniper tree was just the way it had always been, and the cloth with the bones was gone. But Anne-Marie felt so light of heart and so gay, just as if her brother were still alive. And so she went back into the house and was happy and sat down at the table
and ate. But the bird flew away and sat down on the roof of the goldsmith's house and began to sing. My mother, she butchered me. My father, he ate me. My sister, little Anne Marie, she gathered up the bones of me and tied them in a silken cloth to lay under the juniper. Tweet, tweet, what a pretty bird am I. The goldsmith was sitting in his workshop, making a golden chain, and he heard the bird that sat on his roof and sang, and it seemed so beautiful to him. He got up, and as he was walking across the doorstep, he lost one of his slippers, but he kept walking right out into the middle of the street with one slipper and one stocking foot. He had his apron tied around his middle, and in one hand he had the golden chain, and in the other the pliers, and the sun shone so brightly into the street. And he just stood there and looked at the bird. "Bird," said he, "how beautifully you sing. Sing that piece again." "No," said the bird, "the second time I don't sing for nothing. Give me the golden chain and I'll sing it again." "Here," said the goldsmith, "take the golden chain. Now sing it again." And so the bird came and took the golden chain in its right claw and sat in front of the goldsmith and sang. My mother, she butchered me. My father, he ate me. My sister, little Anne Marie, she gathered up the bones of me and tied them in a silken cloth to lay under the juniper. Tweet, tweet, what a pretty bird am I. And so the bird flew off to a cobbler's and sat down on the roof and sang. My mother, she butchered me. My father, he ate me. My sister, little Anne Marie, she gathered up the bones of me and tied them in a silken cloth to lay under the juniper. Tweet, tweet, what a pretty bird am I. The cobbler heard it, and ran out of the door in his shirt sleeves, and looked up to the roof, and had to hold his hand over his eyes so the sun would not blind him.
"Bird," said he, "how beautifully you sing!"
And he called in through the door,
"Wife, come out here a moment. There's a bird here. Look at this bird! And how it can sing!"
And he called his daughter and the children and the servants, the apprentice and the maid, and they all came into the street and saw the bird, how pretty it was, and it had such red feathers and green feathers, and round the neck it was like pure gold, and its eyes glittered and its head like stars.
"Bird," said the cobbler, "sing me that piece again."
"No," said the bird, "the second time I don't sing for nothing. You have to give me a present."
"Wife," said the man, "go to the attic. Up on the top shelf is a pair of red shoes. Bring them down."
And so the wife went up and got the pair of red shoes.
"Here, bird," said the man, "now sing that piece again."
And so the bird came and took the shoes in its left claw and flew back up to the roof and sang,
"My mother, she butchered me. My father, he ate me. My sister, little Anne Marie, she gathered up the bones of me and tied them in a silken cloth to lay under the juniper. Tweet, tweet, what a pretty bird am I."
And when it had finished singing, it flew away. It held the chain in its right claw and the shoes in its left and flew far away to a mill. And the mill went clickety-clack, clickety-clack, clickety-clack. And in the door of the mill sat 20 of the miller's men, hewing a new millstone. And they chopped,
chip-chop, chip-chop, chip-chop.
And the mill went clickety-clack, clickety-clack, clickety-clack. And so the bird went and sat on the linden tree that stood in front of the mill and sang,
"My mother, she butchered me."
and one of them stopped. My father, he ate me. And two more stopped to listen. My sister, little Anne-Marie. And four more stopped. She gathered up the bones of me and tied them in a silken cloth. Now there were only eight still chopping. Too late. Now only five. Under the juniper. Now only one. Tweet, tweet, what a pretty bird am I. And so the last one stopped too, and he had heard only the last part. Bird, said he, how beautifully you sing. I want to hear it too. Sing it again. No, said the bird, the second time I don't sing for nothing. Give me the millstone, and I'll sing it again. Yes, said he, if it belonged to me alone, you could have it. Yes, the others said, if he sings again, he can have it. And so the bird came down, and the millers, all 20 of them, set the beam to and raised up the stone. Heave ho hup! Heave ho hup! Heave ho hup! And the bird stuck its neck through the hole and put it on as if it were a collar and flew back into the tree and sang, my mother, she butchered me. My father, he ate me. My sister, little Anne-Marie, she gathered up the bones of me and tied them in a silken cloth to lay under the juniper. Tweet, tweet, what a pretty bird am I. And when it had finished singing, it spread its wings, and in the right claw it carried the chain, and the shoes in the left, and around the neck it wore the millstone, and flew all the way back to its father's house. Inside, the father, the mother, and Anne-Marie were sitting at the table, and the father said, ah, suddenly my heart feels so easy. Why do I feel so wonderfully good?
No, said the mother. I'm just so frightened, as if there were a great storm coming.
But Anne-Marie sat and cried and cried, and right then the bird came flying along, and as it sat down on the roof, the father said, how happy I'm feeling, and outside the sun is shining so brightly. It's just as if I were going to meet an old friend.
No,
said the wife.
I'm so frightened. My teeth are chattering, and it's as if I had fire in my veins.
And she tore at her bodice to loosen it, but Anne-Marie sat in a corner crying, and held her plate in front of her eyes, and cried so hard she was getting it wet and messy. And so the bird sat in the juniper tree and sang, my mother, she butchered me. And so then the mother stopped her ears up and squeezed her eyes shut and did not want to see or hear. But in her ears it roared like the wildest of storms, and her eyes burned and twitched like lightning. My father, he ate me. Ah, mother, said the man. What a pretty bird, and how sweetly it sings, and the sun's so warm, and everything smells like cinnamon.
My sister, little Anne-Marie.
And Anne-Marie laid her head on her knees, and just kept crying and crying. But the man said, I'm going outside. I must see the bird close up.
Don't go, said the woman. I feel as if the whole house were trembling and in flames.
But the man went outside and looked at the bird.
She gathered up the bones of me and tied them in a silken cloth to lay under the juniper. Tweet, tweet, what a pretty bird am I.
With this, the bird let the golden chain fall, and it fell right around the man's neck, and looked so well on him. And he went inside, and he said,
look at the pretty bird! What a pretty gold chain it gave for me for a present! and how pretty it is to look at!"
But the woman was so frightened, she fell full length on the floor, and the cap fell off her head. And still the bird sang,
"My mother, she butchered me. I wish I were 1,000 miles under the earth so I wouldn't have to hear it. My father, he ate me."
And the woman lay there as if she were dead.
"My sister, little Anne-Marie."
"Ah," said Anne-Marie, "I'm going out too to see if the bird has a present for me." And so she went out.
"She gathered up the bones of me and tied them in a silken cloth."
And here it threw the shoes down to her.
"To lay under the juniper, tweet, tweet, what a pretty bird am I."
And she felt so light-hearted and gay. She put on the new red shoes and came dancing and skipping into the house. "Ah," said she, "I was so sad when I went outside, and now I feel so much better. What a wonderful bird it is. It gave me a pair of red shoes for a present."
"No,"
said the woman, and she jumped up, and her hair stood straight on end like flaming fire.
"It's as if the world were coming to an end. I'm going out, and maybe I will feel better too."
And as she came out of the door, crunch, the bird threw the millstone onto her head, and she was squashed. The father and Anne-Marie heard it and came out. There was steam and flames and fire rising from the spot. And when they were gone, there stood the little brother. And he took his father and Anne-Marie by the hand. And the three of them were so happy and went into the house and sat down at the table and ate their supper. So, I love this crazy story. I love how it, you know, sets up a reality that seems to somewhat resemble a normal world. And then, you know, it undermines it with weird details over and over again. It's fun. Like how time and the seasons seem to warp over the course of the first wife's pregnancy, which otherwise lasts a normal 9 months, or how the 20 millers need to work together to lift the millstone. But then the bird boy just pokes his head through it and casually flies away. You know, there's little gags built into the text that I wasn't expecting to find. Looking at the original, it's noteworthy how the lyrics of the song seem to be in High German, while the rest of the text is written in Low. The German version of the song goes as follows.
Mein Mutter, der mich schlagt, mein Vater, der mich aß, mein Schwester, der Marlenichen, sucht alle meine Bennichen, bind sie in ein Seidentuch, legt sie unter den Machandelbaum, quid, quid, fat von schon vergel bun ich.
The sister's name is Marlenichen in the lyrics, but then in the main text, it's Marlenken. Interestingly, Wikipedia and other English reference material seem to split the difference and call her Marlenken. I have no idea why or how it becomes Anne-Marie in English. When I looked it up, apparently Jack Zipes, in his translation of the first edition that came out a few years ago, he translates it as Marlene. But that seems to lose a bit of significance, because on the one hand, she's the only named character in the story, and the German word for fairy tale, the word for this genre of narrative, is Märchen, which is pretty similar, you know, just with one less syllable. Same beginning and ending sounds. So not sure if that necessarily means anything or if any of this means anything at all. You know, that's always the question with this stuff, right? Like, what does it mean?
Some of the, a lot of the Russian stories are like that too, that we'll be looking at. The sister's constant weeping, is very representative of how femininity is portrayed in these stories. As the feminist scholar Gianna Jorgensen puts it in her 2014 article, Quantifying the Grim Corpus, suffering is written on women's bodies in a way that naturalizes their pain and almost leads us to expect women to cry in fairy tales, unquote. This ubiquitous portrayal of feminine hysteria can then affect how the reader thinks of women in real life. So that's, you know, why it's so important to read this stuff from a critical stance. What particularly draws my attention as a biblical scholar is how often this material subverts and parodies biblical imagery, often to powerful or surreal effect. Here we have, you know, the famous Grimmsian evil stepmother acting out a parody of the temptation in the garden with the offer of the apple. Then there's a parody of the Eucharist and the Trinity, with the Father consuming the Son, a very ancient trope, you know, like Kronos or Saturn devouring his children, that kind of thing. Then we have references to some important sayings of Jesus, specifically the episode where he refers to how God provides for the patena, the birds, even though they don't work for their keep. Then the story more explicitly references the saying about how for a person who leads a child to sin, it would be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a millstone, a lithos mulikos, around his neck. Then there's another layer with using a millstone as a murder weapon, since that's how Abimelech dies in Judges chapter 9. Also, going to the trouble to write out an onomatopoeia for the sound that the mill makes, that could be a reference to Revelation 18, in which an angel throws a millstone into the sea and delivers a monologue about how Babylon's economy will collapse. Phone mulu, the sound of a mill, he says, shall not be heard in you any longer. So that's the juniper tree and a little bit of commentary on the layers of references that are baked in there. For our last piece, I wanted to do a reading in Greek of a fragmentary text by Pseudo-Aristotle. When an author is referred to as pseudo, that means basically just that a text or a body of texts were once traditionally credited to a famous figure. The ones that come to mind are Plato, Aristotle, Hesiod, Paul the Apostle, Apollodorus the Librarian, Galen the Physician, and Dionysius the Areopagite. And then as time passed and the texts were studied more closely, scholars came to the conclusion that they were actually anonymous works by later writers attempting to ape the style of their influences, their forebears. So today, we have the treatises of Pseudo-Plato, Pseudo-Aristotle, and Pseudo-Galen, the letters of Pseudo-Paul, the library of Pseudo-Apollodorus, which is one of the first encyclopedias of Greek mythology, and the mystical theology of Pseudo-Dionysius, and something that I'm going to be reading for Spitting Dust, a poem called The Shield of Heracles by Pseudo-Hesiod. That one's fun because it's actually like kind of an aesthetic precursor to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So we'll be looking at how the scene on Heracles' shield is similar to the Avengers movies, basically. But that's for next time. For this time, I wanted to read Pseudo-Aristotle's The Situation of Winds, which is an interesting little text that fits a lot of geographical information into a small space, but we've already gone on long enough, so I'm going to save that for next time. Instead, I'm going to move straight into the original piece for this episode, tentatively titled The Vision of the Bramble Chamber. This is set in the same animal fable universe as the piece from last episode. Previously, we encountered the famous she-wolf of Roman myth, Lupa, as she took in a pair of abandoned bee larvae and raised them as her own. Later she found that one of them, Eklo, had killed his brother Filio with a sting through the heart. But being a bee, the stinger also pulled out Eklo's own guts, and now he's dying. So Lupa brought in two of her superpowered friends, Tardis the Slow and Eason the Grim, to help out. Eason was in the middle of improvising a mediocre rap verse when he suddenly trailed off and stared into the distance, and we're re-entering the narrative at that point. Eason? He'd never had a vision before, so he wasn't prepared. If his deductive skills were sharper, he'd have questions about what elements of the vision, if any, were to be taken literally. Whether the figures in the vision were significant of particular things or concepts. Those questions. Instead, all he wondered was, "Who's that guy?" The figure was seated in a twisted chamber of thorns, his head in his hands. He wore a gorgeous three-piece suit, with gold threaded along its lapels, edges, and cuffs. The slacks were less flashy, much darker than the suit, the kind of darkness that seems to suck light out of the world around it. The figure wore gloves on his hands, white gloves with ridges on the back and five fingers that each had two hinges, like strategically broken sticks. The figure stood up, and as he approached the mirror, Eason's jaw dropped to the leafy floor. The first clue was the fur that poked out between the cuff of the sleeve and the wrist of the glove. He noticed that honey was oozing out from inside the glove, but it wasn't smeared or crystallized on the freshly washed fur, whose shade was as familiar to Eason as the back of his own paw. When the figure stood in front of the mirror, and Eason saw his own face, grimacing uncomfortably as the glove's fingers fumbled with a top button, his hunch was confirmed. But how could this two-legged monstrosity possibly be his own self? Eason took great pride in the regularity of his handsomeness, in the fact that he was a wolf's wolf, so to speak. His tail, in particular, was noted for its voluminous... Wait a minute! Where Eason's famous, majestic tail should have stood proud from the base of the standing figure's spine, there was only a bristly stump poking out between coattails. What the fuck under the sun was going on here? Suddenly, a door Eason hasn't yet noticed swings open, and a hulking golden bear steps through. Like the other Eason, he is wearing a suit with contrasting threading, but his is red with white thread. He scratches his neck with his right paw, which Eason notices is hewn from creaking linden wood, somehow moving as if it were flesh and bone. He wears no pants. "You forgot this," the bear says, tossing a hat towards the besuited Eason, who puts it on. It has three corners and a pearl buckle on the front. "So," the bear continues, "you ready?"
"I don't know, Otso," the other Eason replies. "It's just such a big step. I feel like my feet are cold, you know?"
"How is that possible? Your shoes never come off. I would assume your feet were permanently warm."
Eason looks down, and for the first time notices that his double's feet are embedded in heavy blocks of concrete, chiseled into the shapes of shoes. Despite this, his other self has no trouble walking about the chamber.
"My feet are not literally cold, you fool's golden oaf! It is a figure of speech! I feel like I want to..."
"Oh, I get it. You want to run away! To heat up your metaphorically cold feet."
"You get me like no one else, brother."
Brother? It would be a cold day indeed when Eason the Grim were ever caught dead referring to a bear as brother.
The bear sticks out his wooden thumb, and the claw extends and sharpens with a splintering sound.
"They're calling for you out there, you know," he says, picking his teeth with it.
Eason hadn't noticed the sound until now, but now that he was paying attention, he heard a distant four-syllable crowd chant. Whatever gathering could make such a din, it must be larger than any that he, the real Eason, had ever seen. All those animals, there for him? He wasn't actually famous, he just liked to think he was, but only real fame could draw such a crowd.
"Oh, I forgot," says the bear. "What was the name?" "Otso," spitting a bone into the corner.
The kid has a gift for you. From the darkness beyond the still open door, Eason hears the sound of something, making horrible clicking and wheezing sounds as it drags itself across the threshold. It was a fox, but it wasn't a fox. It stood up too, first of all, hugging something to its chest, but where its head should be, its tail sprouted from its shoulders instead. Its fur was a sickly pale ochre, and its lower half seemed to be twisted around backwards. Where its tail should be, there was instead a malformed head, showing no signs of life. The dragging sound was from its forehead scraping the ground, and Eason saw that its tongue lolled out, disgustingly purple, and both of its eyeballs trailed behind like tin cans on strings. Despite these difficulties, it runs sprightly across the large chamber. The other Eason's attitude towards the thing is strange, almost fatherly. He kneels before the creature.
"Hey, champ! How you doing today?" "That good, huh? And you have something for me?"
The creature holds out the strange red fabric it had folded up, and both Eason's see that it is another fox's pelt, a deep cherry red that takes the breath away. Bizarrely, it's edged all around with teeth, some of which have been broken or filed down.
"Oh, wow! Hardrain, you shouldn't have? I'm not sure what to do with this."
Otso takes off his suit and hangs it on a thorn, taking advantage of the wall full of them to scratch his back.
"That's not it. That's what he's gonna wear when he bears the rings. Come on, kid, what about the other thing? What do you want to give?"
The creature rummages around in the bush of his tail and procures a pure white feather.
"Whoa! Where did you—"
"Plucked from King Cock himself, believe it or not," says Otso.
"You got this from Chanticleen? Wow, Hardrain, I'm so proud of you. And it's for me?"
He takes it and sticks it in the fold of his hat.
"Yeah, Hardy Boy's very proud of it," says the bear. "I think he wants to name it for some reason. Hardrain, what was the name you came up with? Macarena or something like that?"
The jaws of the creature's posterior head move weakly as it tries to speak.
"Macaroni!"
"Yeah, that's what it was. Macaroni."
Otso adjusts his stance to reach a difficult itch. Suddenly, the wall opens behind him, and the bear's entire bulk pratfalls backwards with a great thud. A long corridor hollows out, and a cluster of light is seen at the end. As it approaches, Eason sees that it is another figure, besuited like his double, but with the head of a serpent, and a body fashioned entirely out of bramble and briar. He is pushing a cart loaded with torches, mounting them in sconces on the walls as he goes. He enters the chamber with the empty cart, and sees the grotesque fox creature holding out his crimson gift.
"Ugh, it's you," the serpent says. He pitily and viciously kicks the creature across the room, where it is impaled on a thorn.
"Fuck, Crom, are you serious?"
the bear snaps.
"Do we kick your highly expensive research projects around? No, we fucking don't."
The other Eason throws off his suit, revealing the body underneath. Still recognizably his own, but distorted, twisted into this upright form. This other him runs towards the beast, clearly in a panic, leaving craters in the ground beneath.
Shh, it's okay, Hardrain, it's okay, stop wriggling, and I'll just ease you off of there. You'll be healed up in no time, I promise."
Seeing the thorn plunged through the pathetic beast's body reminds Eason of something. Something he's supposed to be doing. Suddenly he is yanked away, and the scene recedes from view. As his consciousness rockets up from the depths of his brain, the chanting grows louder, clearer. Then he hears two voices somewhere in the darkness, one booming and firm, the other croaking and strained.
"Papa! What if he doesn't like me?"
croaks one. Eason hears the clop of hooves as if a horse is anxiously pacing the floor somewhere. But it sounds like more than four hooves, all in unison.
Oh-ho-ho, Bell,
booms the other.
What choice does he have?
In the last moment, the wolf hears the chanting loud and clear.
Eason Gray Moose! Eason Gray Moose!
Eason? He snaps out, and he's back in the familiar wilderness. There are Lupa, and Tardis the Slow, and the tragic Bee Brothers. I could continue, but let's leave off there. Next time, we'll see what happens to Eklo the Bee, and get some insight into the ugly nature of Lupa and Eason's relationship, as he attempts to confide in her about this vision. All right, so that's it for this time around. I hope I haven't bored you all to tears, and that you join us next time on And the Beans Talk. Stay safe and well, everyone.